Hello, welcome to Mind Chat. I'm Philip Goff. First solo Mind Chat. No Keith. What are we going to do without Keith? What are we going to do without Keith wittering crap in my ear all the time? I love him, really. Just joking, of course. Anyway, this isn't going to be a real full-length Mind Chat. Just wanted to share a few quick thoughts about the last Mind Chat. Not going to take too long, maybe 30 minutes. And something I forgot to say last time, as always, do like the video, subscribe to the channel and the podcast, comment, write nice reviews to help get this wonderful content, I should be more modest than I really, out to a broader audience. Okay, so what we're talking about is the last Mind Chat debate discussion with Sean Carroll and Barry Lower. So it was a really good debate, but maybe the most heated debate of Mind Chat so far. But I thought it was, really good discussion. I couldn't stop weekend after. I kind of couldn't stop thinking about it. And I was really, motivated, stimulated some deep thinking, which is what we're all about here. And so I came to the conclusion, I think I made two mistakes in the debate. So I want to share that. I think I kind of made two mistakes. But overall, having reflected on those mistakes, I actually do feel sort of more confident about my overall argument after that. We are live, aren't we, everybody? Yes. So anyway, okay. So I'll just 10 or 15 minutes, I'll just share these thoughts. I did ask Sean and Barry if they wanted to be here, but I think they're otherwise engaged, but I'll send them the video. If they would like, write a reply, they're very welcome to come back on and talk. Although these discussions, they can't go on forever, can they? I just want them to go on forever. But anyway, I don't want it to be just like, I'm insisting on the last word. So they'd be very welcome to share some thoughts. Okay, so here's where we're up to. We are live, aren't we? Can someone just confirm to me we're live so I'm not talking to myself? Are we live? Someone just want to say in the comments? Yes, Queerdo, thank you very much. Okay, so just a quick reminder of the last topic. So we're discussing strong emergentism. I'm inclined to think that there are significant philosophical grounds to accept the consciousness is strongly emergent in the sense that when it emerges, it either creates new fundamental laws or modifies old laws. The universe runs a little bit differently when biological consciousness emerges. I should say, I, as a panpsychist, I think consciousness is always already there at the level of fundamental physics, but when biological consciousness emerges, the universe runs a little bit differently. We haven't gone, you know, we're not going too much into why I think that. I mean, it starts with familiar arguments against a materialist reduction of consciousness. I would start with a knowledge argument, although I think you need a few more steps. But of course, that leaves open a kind of panpsychist reduction. I am open to a sort of panpsychist reduction of our sensory experience, our experience of colors, sounds, smells, tastes. But I think I'm inclined to think cognitive experience is, in a certain sense, irreducible, by which I mean the experience that constitutes thought or understanding. This is something I haven't really talked that much about, but my new book, I talk a lot more about cognitive experience. So when people think about consciousness, they always give the examples of seeing color, feeling pain, but I'm inclined to think consciousness is mediated with meaning and with what things are and what they mean, and that this is something we're really not even at first base in thinking about. But anyway, that's not so much the focus. Maybe that's a topic for future, but the point is that I, like many philosophers, think there is strong philosophical grounds for taking the biological consciousness to be strongly emergent. Okay, and then Sean offers this physics-based response to that. So he thinks we have good reason to accept the core theory is the correct and complete theory of the matter in our bodies and brains, and then thinks that this gives a strong reason for thinking there is no strong emergence in the brain. So the core theory being the standard model of particle physics plus the weak limit of general relativity. You may know it's a challenge to bring together quantum mechanics and relativity, general relativity, but we can do this. We can reconcile them, as I understand it, in terrestrial circumstances within certain energy levels. If the gravity is not incredibly strong, like when you're about to go in a black hole, we can actually bring them together. And this we call the core theory. And then my initial response to this from, this is just recap of the last debate, is, well, the experimental conditions, and this was agreed on by all parties, the experimental conditions in which we have tested the core theory do not include complex biological systems, and hence we have no significant empirical ground to deny strong emergence in the brain. And then Sean and Barry came out with effectively saying in different ways, I think, well, look, you've still got a well-confirmed scientific theory here, the core theory, which, if it does apply in our brains, rules out strong emergence. Okay, so I think here's I think what the biggest mistake I made in the discussion, I decided afterwards. So I think I was too quick to sort of concede that, you know, we should first start with what theory is suggested by the experiments, and then bring in the data from consciousness to see whether we should change that theory. So it's a sort of two-step process. You know, you work out the theory that best explains the experiments in particle physics, and then you bring in the alleged consciousness-based evidence and maybe modify the theory. Now, if you go in that kind of two-step way, that starts to look bad because you've already got a well-confirmed theory that you might be reluctant to modify. But of course, for people with my philosophical views, the data from experiments and the data from consciousness are both starting points for theorizing, right? Before we get to a theory, we've got these two kinds of data. And crucially, they're not conflicting, right? If we tested the core theory in brains, and we had experimental grounds for doubting strong emergence in brains because we tested it, then from my perspective, I'd have conflicting evidence, right? The philosophical evidence points in favor of strong emergence. The empirical evidence counts against. But I don't think that's what we've got here. Everyone in this debate concedes we haven't tested it in brains or complex living systems. We just tested it with, you know, experiments involving small numbers of particles. And you know, I just think we need to keep coming back to what do we have evidence for? I know Sean, like me, likes to think of evidence in Bayesian terms. And when we do that, we think, what kind of evidence would you expect given a certain hypothesis? So let's assume that the hypothesis of strong emergence, that laws become modified somewhat in complex biological systems. Suppose that view is true. Would you expect to find evidence for that when you perform experiments on small numbers of particles? Well, no, of course you wouldn't, because by definition, strong emergence is something that kicks in complex systems. So the evidence, the results of experiments with small numbers of particles, neither counts in favor nor against strong emergence, right? So from my perspective, you know, I've got this philosophical evidence for strong emergence. I don't have experimental evidence counting against that. I've got some other experimental evidence, the results of experiments in particle physics, and the task is to come up with a theory that accommodates both sort of data. And that, I suggest that would lead you to a modified form of the core theory, which allows for strong emergence in brains. So you'd never get to the core theory, right? Because the rational task for someone with my philosophical views is to formulate a theory that can account for both sets of data. Now, a lot of the discussion seems to be, well, this is hard to do. Okay, fine. If it's if it's hard to formulate a theory which can account for two sets of data, you don't jettison one kind of data, right? You keep going and you try and formulate a theory that accounts for both sorts of data. Again, if your two kinds of data or two putative kinds of data are conflicting, then you're in trouble. Something's got to give, right? If we tested the core theory in brains and we had evidence against strong emergence, I'd have to give up something. But that's not what we find. We've got two kinds of evidence that are not conflicting. The task is to construct a theory that accommodates both. So you never get to this point where you've got a well-confirmed theory that counts against strong emergence, right? Your starting point is the philosophical evidence for strong emergence, the non-conflicting data from experiments in particle physics. The rational task motivation then is to formulate a theory that can account for both. Okay, now a lot of the discussion, it seemed to, and we continued emailing following this. We brought in David Papineau as well, who was discussing it with us. And, you know, it just seems to keep coming back to locality, right? The principle of locality. And this is my other mistake, I think, as I conceded in the discussion, really. I should have thought more about this, and I was annoyed at myself that I didn't think more about this issue before the discussion. Okay, I was discussing this with Brian McLaughlin yesterday. We were discussing this paragraph from Sean's paper he drew my attention to, which I should have really reflected on more before the debate. Okay, so I'll just read out this paragraph, which is a bit hard for me to see. In the context of an effective field theory, locality of interactions implies, so the principle of locality, that the electromagnetic and gravitational fields, or unknown fifth force fields, produced by an object are simply the net fields produced by each of the constituent particles individually. Outside the effective field theory paradigm, we could imagine that forces depend non-locally on sources, so that whether or not a force is produced would depend on the special arrangement of particles within it. So this is just strong emergence. Such a force might not be produced by a collection of electrons, protons, and neutrons in the form of a cantaloupe, not sure how you pronounce that, for example, but it might be produced by the same particles when they are in the form of a human brain. To the best of my knowledge, this possibility has not been investigated carefully. And to be honest, there's not a lot of motivation for it. So this is really just an articulation of strong emergence. And sure, there's no motivation for it from physics, right? My motivation for it is not empirical, but is philosophical. I should say it's not just philosophers who go for strong emergence. The neuroscientist Kevin Mitchell, the chemist Lee Cronin, and Sarah Walker share the view that there is strong emergence in the sense of new causal principles over and above the laws of physics that emerge as the universe evolves. Sorry. I had a chocolate biscuit before I started. I think it's sort of giving me some problems. So there are a variety of motivations for strong emergence. But yes, you're not going to get motivation for strong emergence from physics itself. My motivation is philosophical. But now, you know, if like me, you do think there is philosophical grounds for accepting strong emergence, then from the off, you are not going to you're not going to have any rational grounds at all to go for a principle of locality, which is pretty much by definition inconsistent with strong emergence, right? If your starting point is evidence for strong emergence, other non-conflicting experimental evidence, what am I going to go for? You're not going to go for a theory which commits to locality. You might hold that locality holds in a certain limited domain of applicability in the circumstances where there isn't strong emergence, but there's going to be no rational motivation to adopt principle of locality. So again, the rational task would be to account for both source of data. Now, I can't really see there is any force here that counterbalancing the alleged philosophical evidence for strong emergence. Of course, let's hold that thought. Now, in the email discussion following, Sean sort of developed this objection a little bit, going beyond, I think, what is in the paper, and saying, well, these kind of violations of locality may entail faster than light signaling. And that might start to get a bit worrying. If we have to give up relativity, special relativity, then okay, this might start to look a bit worrying. But I'm not yet seeing why that would have to be. So it could be that macro level consciousness strongly emerges, not instantaneously. Okay, so just let me say, actually, before I get to my response, how I think Sean is... I'm going on too long, aren't I? How I think Sean is thinking about this. I think, you know, if it was the case that an electron, let's just take a given electron, behaves differently in a brain than it does when floating in the air or something, then I think he's thinking, well, that would effectively be sort of instantaneous signaling from the whole brain to the particle. But I don't think we need to think about it that way, right? You don't have to think that consciousness strongly emerges instantaneously. It might emerge period of time P after a certain period of time, let's call it P, after the relevant configuration weakly emerges, where P is the time it'd take for light to get around the system. So let's suppose the integrated information theory were the correct theory of strong emergence. So when you get more integrated information in the whole system than its parts, that's where you get strong emergence. Well, it could be that if we want to respect relativity, we could just say, well, when we get to the point at which there's more integrated information in the whole system than the parts, right, you don't get consciousness emerging instantaneously, you get consciousness emerging a short period of time later, and that period of time is the period of time it would take light to get around the system. Okay, that's my thought. Maybe this doesn't work out, but it's not obvious to me. So A, with locality, I mean, you're just going to have absolutely no rational motivation to adopt locality if you're starting from the position that there is philosophical evidence for strong emergence, because it's sort of by definition inconsistent with that. And I don't see why we can not accept locality, at least not as broadly in a broader domain of application as Sean wants to, while still accepting relativity. Okay, final slide, and then let's see if people can ask questions. So now again, you might think, look, I think these alleged philosophical evidence of strong emergence is just BS. And that's, you know, and that's what we got bogged down in arguing, and, you know, probably me and Barry got a bit technical. I think we got bogged down in arguing for that. And that's, you know, it's an important debate. But, you know, in a way, the point I was making, it doesn't matter whether those arguments work or not. Here's the point I was making. Either there is compelling philosophical evidence that consciousness implies strong emergence, or there isn't. If there is, then we should combine that evidence for strong emergence with the evidence from experience. I think that should be just experiments. Sorry, that should be experiments, not experience. With the evidence from experiments to support the thesis that a modified version of the core theory, which allows for strong emergence in the brain. There's something gone wrong with the phrasing there. To support a modified version of the core theory, which allows strong emergence in the brain, right? So if there is strong philosophical evidence for strong emergence, then you'll factor that in from the start. You'll never reach the core theory. You'll reach a modified version of core theory. If there isn't, then we should just stick to the core theory on grounds of simplicity, unless someone like Lee Cronin or Kevin Mitchell are right that there's other empirical grounds for strong emergence. Either way, this is the crucial point. Reflection on physics does not counterbalance the philosophical arguments of strong emergence. This is the important point, because, right, when you take a first year philosophy course or second year philosophy of mind, including my own course, what you'll be taught the sort of arguments against physicalism that I put forward, and others, you know, like the knowledge argument, conceivability arguments, and so on. And then students are like, oh, right, maybe there's some motivation for doubting physicalism. Then you get these kind of alleged empirical arguments against strong emergence. We call it causal closure, this idea, roughly that there's no strong emergence. And people think, oh no, I've got two conflicting things. I've got to balance them up. I want to say, no, there is almost nothing on the other side of the ledger, right? If these arguments work, then you'll factor them in from the start of theorizing and you'll never reach a position where you end up with a scientific theory inconsistent with strong emergence. I mean, if they don't work, then they don't work and we don't need to worry about them. Either way, the only thing we should be discussing are those philosophical arguments, right? Don't pretend there's something in physics that's giving us reason to doubt those arguments. So, and again, you might just say, look, this is still just wasting my time because those arguments are just so terrible. You know, I'm sure Sean and Barry don't have time for those arguments. They think, you know, it's so terrible. But again, you know, Barry kicked off by saying they did crap arguments. But again, 32% of philosophers accept those arguments. 52% as against 52% who do not accept them. The remaining people are agnostic or don't like the question or something. You know, I think whichever side of that debate you are on, you should have some humility that a huge proportion of experts in this field do accept those arguments. And I wonder how much those stats would change if it were appreciated that there is nothing on the other side of the ledger, which is why I really want to press this point. Okay, I think that's all I have to say. If anyone, I've talked longer than I intended. What do you think? If you want to put up Q and then a questions, I haven't been following the chat because I've been speaking. Anyone have any thoughts? If you just want to put up a Q. Quido, agreed completely, Philip. That was just the next comment that came up. So Quido says, agreed completely, Philip. It's the metaphysical arguments that are the most important thing. Going into physics doesn't do anything. Some people think physics somehow are on an argument. Physics somehow are an argument for physicalism. Yeah, I mean, look, it's not that... I wouldn't want to say, you know, in general, philosophy is more important than empirical science. As I say, you know, if we tested this in the brain and we reached strong evidence that there is no strong emergence in living systems, that would count very strongly. I would probably, you know, seriously rethink my philosophical arguments at that point. And that's what I used to think. That's the impression you get as a philosophical and as a philosophy undergraduate. And that's why I defended for a long time a sort of reductionist panpsychist picture. Because I thought, look, there's this strong... I just think if we're just talking about the theory you are led to on the basis of experiments on small numbers of particles, that doesn't give us any reason. That's not going to give us any reason to doubt strong emergence, because you wouldn't expect, again, thinking in Bayesian terms, you wouldn't expect evidence of strong emergence from experiments on small numbers of particles. Okay. Okay, so Quido agrees with me. So, A. Raybould says, if Frank Jackson's Mary learned all completed physics from her studies, would she be surprised, satisfy her curiosity on first seeing colours? Okay, well, seems to be the argument I was having with Barry. So, as I said, I think we kind of got too bogged down in the arguments, the philosophical arguments for strong emergence. I mean, my starting point is the knowledge argument. Barry's response to the knowledge argument is a very familiar one. Sean kind of scoffed at one point that I was not understanding his view because I kept saying it's the view that Mary gets a new label. I do very, very well understand Barry's view. I think, to be honest, he was being a little bit pedantic rejecting that description of it. The position he adopts, which is the phenomenal concept strategy, probably the most popular physicalist response to these arguments, is that what Mary gains is a new way of referring to experience. So she already, an experience is just a brain state. Mary already knew about the relevant brain state, but now she gets a new way of referring to it, a new way of sort of pointing at it. It's a little bit like, you know, the example I give in my lectures. If you, you know, say my kid looks in the star sky and that bright star. And then one day she learns it's Venus. She hasn't learned about anything new. She's just learned a new way of referring to the same thing. So I tend to teach that by saying it's a new label. I think, to be honest, Barry was splitting hairs, rejecting that description of the view. But my response to that is to do with this curiosity thought that I think Mary's curiosity is, she might be curious. I wonder what it's like to see red. She sees red and she thinks, oh, that's what it's like. And her curiosity is satisfied. How can your curiosity be satisfied by gaining a new way of referring to something? I think by definition, curiosity is about gaining information. I'm going to write a paper on this in the near future, I think. Okay. Oh, I could put the questions up, couldn't I? Sorry. A. Raybould again. This question bears on the nature of the evidence and consciousness. Yeah, okay. There's a legitimate debate. I've just tried to gesture at the starting point of my position on it. And we can have that debate. And I certainly respect Barry and Sean's rejection of that debate. But the point is, everything hangs and falls on the debates. There's nothing in physics that counterbalances this. That's my claim. So yeah, you think the arguments are a load of nonsense? Sure, reject them. Have the argument, reject them. Think you should have a bit of humility given that, you know, a large proportion of experts do accept those arguments, but reject those arguments and just go for the core theory because that's what physics suggests. But it's all just about having those philosophical arguments. Okay. I'm just going through these in order. Elite Puffin, nice name. It's still unclear to me how strong emergence is supposed to provide the extra information consciousness, stroke consciousness that Philip wants it to. It doesn't seem to have much bearing on the hard problem. So what's the thought here? How is this solve the hard problem? Well, look, I mean, what the hard problem is just, I mean, what is your theory of consciousness? Is it fundamental, like in the soul? Does it emerge from something more fundamental? If you think it emerges from something more fundamental, then you maybe need to give some account of that to try and make sense of that. And you face a challenge from these arguments, like the knowledge argument, at least if you're giving a sort of materialistic reduction. If you think it's strongly emergent, and you think there's philosophical reason to think it's strongly emergent, well, that's just your view. I mean, well, unless you can tell me a problem with that view, then I would say that's my philosophically well-supported view that there's no empirical reason to doubt. So I just think that's the most likely theory of consciousness. You know, I sometimes think materialists build into, you know, a solution to the hard problem has got to be reductive or something, but that's just kind of begging the question in the technical sense of assuming what you're trying to prove. Okay. Oh, I've somehow skipped ahead, but I don't want to do that. Just, it might look like I'm cheating. Okay. Mark O'Brien. Hi, Mark. Could you explain how strong emergence helps? I don't, for example, see how it resolves the knowledge argument. Suppose Mary knows the SE laws, the strongly emergent laws. Okay. So this is a variation on the last question. So the thought would be, I mean, what Mary doesn't know is there's a new property that strongly emerges, right? There's a new property that strongly emerges. And that property is one people like me try to push. You couldn't learn about from physical science. It's the qualitative character of a red experience, what it's like to see red. You couldn't deduce that kind of property from just from the purely quantitative physical science. So there's a new property. Okay, so then the thought would be it strongly emerges. It's a brand new property in some sense. Again, I'm kind of open to a panpsychist reductionism about red experience. It's more the cognitive stuff that does it for me. But let's just set that on one side. So Mark's point is, what it could, she could know the strongly emergent laws. Okay, well, in what sense? I mean, she could know that, like, strong emergence occurs when you have more integrated information in the whole and the parts or something. She could know that. And she still wouldn't know the nature of the property that the the qualitative character of the experience. She might have some way of finding that out. I mean, I'm inclined to think you have to actually have the experience. So maybe, I mean, maybe it's like this. It depends what you mean by knowing the laws. If by knowing the laws, you mean actually grasping the nature of the property that strongly emerges, well, then you can't actually do that until you've had the experience. But I don't see why that undermines the theory that there's strong emergence here. But if by knowing the laws, you mean she just knows when it's going to pop up without grasping the nature of property, then she could know that. And again, I don't see what either way we've got a problem here. The problem emerges is when you're trying to give a materialist reduction and you have to say there isn't a new property. There's maybe a weakly emergent property, but there isn't a strongly emergent property. And that's problematic because something emerges here that Murray didn't know about and really satisfies her curiosity. So that fits with a strong emergentist view. It doesn't fit with a materialist reduction. Okay, Emerson, didn't Carroll try to argue the core theory just stipulates that it applies in biology? Yeah, so look, it is the core theory does rule out strong emergence. Fine. The core theory does rule out strong emergence. But my point is, if your starting point is experiments of particle physics and this philosophical evidence for strong emergence, then you're looking for the rational thing to do is look for a theory that accommodates both, and you're not going to be led to the core theory. You're not going to be led to something a million miles away. You're going to be led to a modified version of it, where locality is in a more limited domain of applicability. And sure, I mean, I forgot to put the papers in the notes. I'll put the paper. I'll definitely put the papers by Sean in the notes to this one and the previous video. He actually, in his paper responding to my book, he actually suggests some ways in which the core theory could be modified to allow for strong emergence. So I think you'd be led to that. I mean, it would be different if, as I say, this is not just saying, oh, we're going to accept the philosophy, hell or high water, you know, empirical evidence counts for nothing. The point is, these are not conflicting. The evidence from particle physics experiments can't possibly cast doubt on strong emergence because, thinking in Bayesian terms, you would not expect strong emergence to be evident if you're just talking about dealing with small numbers of particles. By definition, it emerges in complex systems. So we've got these two non-conflicting sources of data, one of which is that there is strong emergence in brains. You're going to come up with a theory that's a modified version of the core theory that allows for strong emergence. Okay. What does consciousness affect? Well, I mean, my conscious thoughts have some connection to what I'm saying now. If the doctor's asking me how my pain feels, then I think that the character of my pain has impact on what I'm saying. I mean, I think... And obviously, as a panpsychist, I think there's very simple forms of consciousness at the level of fundamental physics. And so in some sense, it's... anything that happens is caused by consciousness because at the fundamental level, all there is consciousness. On the panpsychist view, physics is... The mathematical structures physics identifies are realized by networks of simple conscious entities. So, yeah, I mean, in some sense, on the panpsychist view, all there is consciousness. So anything that happens is caused by consciousness. If you're talking about biological consciousness, well... we don't have all the details worked out. We don't. Nobody has a complete theory of consciousness, but I think we know a lot about the kinds of effects consciousness has: human consciousness, animal consciousness. I don't know what I mean. I think there's supposed to be some kind of challenge here. I mean, if you think there's empirical evidence against strong emergence, then as an anti-physicalist, you might have a challenge. How we make sense of consciousness causing stuff, but I reject that there is any such empirical evidence. So yeah, I'm not clear what the challenge is supposed to be here. Okay, Quido, It would count strongly against strong emergence, but not against cosmopsychism. What would... I'm not sure why that's following on from what would count strong. I mean, look, there's all sorts of complicated things here. As I said, I'm open to a panpsychist reduction of some kinds of consciousness, sensory consciousness, but not really cognitive consciousness. Some people, maybe this is what Queerdo is getting at, some people might think, and actually I did in my academic book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, I did partly argue that we can't really give a micropsych, a particle-based reduction of biological consciousness, where the fundamental forms of consciousness are at the micro level, but we might be able to give a cosmopsychist reduction where the fundamental forms of consciousness are kind of universe-wide fields. That might be a more plausible reduction. So one might think, you know, one might reject physicalism, but think there are some plausible forms of panpsychist reductionism, perhaps cosmopsychist versions. But I'm inclined to think, at least when it comes to cognitive consciousness, really all forms of reduction are pretty implausible. But that's all surprises I'm yet to unveil for my new book. Richard, why do we need strong emergence? What has argument for strong emergence to do with phenomenal consciousness? What would data theory of phenomenal consciousness look like? Well, again, the starting point is, I think there are these very powerful arguments against materialist reductions of consciousness, against consciousness as a weakly emergent phenomenon in a sort of physicalist materialist paradigm, the knowledge argument. So I think that already gives us reason to take strong emergence seriously. It's complicated because there might be alternative panpsychist reductions, but I think there are also already some problems with that, which at least when it comes to cognitive experience. But I mean, fair enough. I haven't gone into that here. I mean, look, here's another. I mean, suppose you thought that, come to, you know, libertarian free will again. Suppose you thought there was really a really good philosophical argument for libertarian free will. I think you'd be in the same position. People think there's all sorts of there's really strong. I mean, well, there's Sabina Hossenfelder's video where she talks about, you know, physics disproves libertarian free will. I think for the same reasons, no, it doesn't. If your starting point is, I've got this really strong philosophical ground for believing in libertarian free will, I'm not saying I do, but suppose you did, and then you've got the evidence in particle physics. Nothing in particle physics, I mean, nothing in the experiments, I've got to distinguish the theory from the experiments, nothing in the experiments on small numbers of particles either support or disconfirm libertarian free will, because libertarian free will obviously is only going to emerge at high levels of complexity. And if your starting point is strong philosophical grounds for libertarian free will and particle experiments of particle physics, you're going to be led to a modified version of the core theory which accommodates both of these things. Things are slightly more complicated with libertarian free will, actually. It's a little bit unclear whether conservation of energy would be a problem there, if you're having sort of something spontaneous rather than totally law-governed. But look, there's a nuanced point here I'm trying to get across, and it's always hard to get a... I'm just saying, if you have philosophical grounds, which I do, but the point is, if you have strong philosophical grounds, there's nothing in physics to counterbalance that, right? And that's important, because I think a lot of philosophers think, oh, there's these philosophical arguments, strong emergence, but then physics, oh my God. There is nothing on the other side of the ledger. Which data would... what would a theory of phenomenal consciousness look like? Oh, sorry, I'm pressing the wrong thing. I was trying to go into the next comment. Well, look, I mean, look at my paper, How Exactly Does Panpsychism Explain Consciousness, on my website. Get back to me if there's any problems with it. Chalmers' master argument deals with PCS very well. I'm actually not. This is the difference. Me and David Chalmers are on the same side, but I actually don't totally buy his arguments as we discussed when we had him on Mindchat. Well, let's not get in. We could talk another time about why I don't think Chalmers' master argument works, but I give slightly different arguments. This satisfying curiosity point being a new one. Well, it sort of builds on my old ones, sort of. Okay, Navid asks, consciousness seems to be emergent, strong versus weak. Emergence definition is what defines what type of emergence emerges in the brain. Yeah, that's it. That's a crew. I think, you know, everyone would accept consciousness is emergent in some sense. There are some people that panpsychist Siddharth, who thinks actually my consciousness is the consciousness of a particle. And in ingenious ways defends that view. I guess Leibniz had something like that view, his monads. But I said, you know, almost everyone would think, yeah, consciousness is emergent in some sense. The question is weak or strong. I think there's good philosophical evidence for strong, and I don't think anything in particle physics casts doubt on that. James, question, are there specific authors, pieces you would direct someone to on the empirics of whether there is strong emergence in general? Well, as an empirical question, I think, as I say, neuroscientist Kevin Mitchell, Lee Crone. I mean, me and Sean were at a conference that week before last run by Paul Davies, physicist, where Lee Cronin and Sarah Walker were talking about their work, which, if I'm understanding it correctly, does involve some kind of strong emergence, that new causal principles emerge as the universe evolves, something I'd like to talk to them about more. Someone I've mentioned a lot as well, Martin Picard from Columbia, who works on mitochondria in the brain and thinks we should understand them as sort of irreducible social networks rather than reducible to underlying chemistry and physics. So as an empirical question, our first mind chat with Tim O'Connor is probably the philosopher who's worked most on strong emergence, and he has a dualist view of strong emergence. But yeah, it's outside of my skill set to assess these empirical arguments. My motivation is philosophical. This is going on longer than I intended, but I definitely have to finish in a few minutes, I think. If physicalism is too much fun talking about these things. If physicalism is considered out of touch by the naive folk, and if that contingency of experts consistently evidences borderline pathological conclusions of evidence or language gaming, then I'm not totally sure what you're getting here. I think you're I think you're casting doubt on these philosophical arguments. Well, look, you know, I mean, the scientistic position that the only way of finding out about reality is from experiments is itself a philosophical position. There is no peer-reviewed academic experimental paper which proves scientism, right? There's a philosophical dispute. I think there's something we know with pretty close to certainty is a real phenomenon. The reality of our own feelings and experiences, that's not something we know about from experiments and observation. We know about it from our immediate awareness. And then there's a philosophical question, what to make of that data? What is required to account for that data? That's a philosophical question, because we're not starting with experiment. If you're just starting with experimental data, leave it to the scientists. But this is not... One thing Sean said that I regret not picking up on. He said, oh, this is just a fake debate, dispute between what goes on inside our bodies and what goes on outside of our bodies. Like, there's going to be some big difference here. That's not the point, that it's inside our bodies. The point is an epistemic one. Like, the data here, the data point is not one of observation and experiments. If you're just trying to account for observation experiments, you'd never need to postulate consciousness. You just postulate mechanisms to explain behavior. But there's something here we know to be real, that our theory of overall theory of reality has to account for, namely the reality of one's own feelings and experiences. And is that, that's not an experimental datum in the sense of public observation experiments. And there's a philosophical question, whichever way you come down on it, as to what is required to account for that. one philosophical position is some kind of strong emergence is required to account for that. Okay, and among the relevant experts, a huge proportion don't accept this, reject physicalist reduction of it, at least. Luke, any predictions about what we'd find in the brain? Any theory of emergence here? Look, we know, the more I talk to neuroscientists, I always come back to this great book by Matthew Cobb, The Idea of the Brain. Matthew Cobb, who's not at all sympathetic to panpsychism or dualism, as are, you know, Kevin Mitchell and Lee Cronin, neither. We know very little about the workings of the brain. We know a lot about the basic chemistry, how neurons fire, action potentials. We know a fair bit about large-scale functions. We know very little about how large-scale functions are realized at the cellular level. So I think we'd need to know a lot more. As I said, Sean himself considers in very broad brushstrokes how one might modify the core theory. But of course, I just don't think we know enough about the brain to sort of know where. I mean, if IIT, one thing I like about integrated information theory is because it allows that consciousness is not vague. Maybe I'll talk. We're going to have a mind chat on that with Eric Schwitzgebel soon. So if you know, it depends on the theory. If the integrated information theory turns out to be true, well, then we're going to get strong emergence when there's more integrated information in the whole than the parts. And in fact, this gives the potential for important way of moving forward with the science of consciousness in principle, although I don't think we're able to deal with this experimentally as yet. But, you know, searching for the neural correlates of consciousness is a mess, right? As I've said before, Christoph Koch bet 25 years ago, bet David Chalmers, a crate of fine wine, we'd have it all wrapped up by now. There is no consensus. There is a total split on whether consciousness is in the front of the brain or the back of the brain. And part of this is consciousness is not publicly observable. But if consciousness is associated with strong emergence, then in principle, that's a really hardcore empirical signpost. So if it turns out that there is, you know, strong emergence in the front of the brain rather than the back of the brain, I mean, not just in the front of the brain, in the particular places where people on that side of the debate locate consciousness, as opposed to the places more at the back of the brain where people on that side of the debate locate consciousness, that would be a major point in their favor. So, I mean, I suspect there's a challenge in the background here. Oh, you can't say more. This is rubbish theory. But my motivation, that would be fair point if my motivation was empirical, but my motivation is philosophical. And as I say, there are empirical scientists I've already mentioned who take strong emergence seriously as well. Magnesium butt in cigarette. How the hell does Mary learn nothing about the reality? Not sure what you mean by that, sorry. Aaron Shaw. Hello, Aaron. If Galileo's move to separate quantitative from qualitative caused or contributed to modern science effectiveness, why wouldn't putting the quantitative back into the model be a step backwards? Good, yeah. I marked a really good essay to... I shouldn't. Maybe talk about I'm preparing for this debate with Anil Seth about fourth or fifth debate in Liverpool this Friday with also the Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. Quite excited about this. It's going to be on the Unbelievable channel, but I'm rethinking. I mean, so look, the subtitle of my book is Towards a New Science of Consciousness. And I'm thinking, I mean, there are two ways of doing this. We can either have a more expansive conception of science, or you can just say, well, look, science is one thing, dealing with public observation experiments, but we need philosophy as well. And because there are things we know to be real that aren't known on the basis of public observation experiments. So I'm thinking maybe taking that line more now, just saying, look, pressing, you know, maybe, I mean, this is just a terminological issue, whether we move to a more expansive conception of science or whether we stick to our limited conception of science, but just say, look, we need to take philosophy more seriously in theorizing about the nature of reality. But in either case, look, Aaron, you know, every time I do a talk for scientists, there was this conference a couple of weeks ago, You know, there's always the frustration. Oh, but it's going to be really imprecise. It's going to be harder to establish with it if we're just reasoning rather than doing experiments. I get all that. It is going to be less satisfying, but you either pretend consciousness doesn't exist or you deal with it. And because consciousness is not publicly observable, it can't just be the whole story is science as usual. Sadly, I would like it if it was. I wanted logical positivism to be true, but we realized 70 years ago it wasn't, sadly. But because no one takes philosophy seriously, we kind of go around in these circles of revisiting positivism. Oh, look, I've gone. I'm trying to do the comments in order, but I'm really going to have to go. I have to make the next one the last question. I'm just trying to find the next... Oh, here we go. Okay. Navid, it would be a horrible step backwards. Okay, I think I've already dealt with that. Okay, let's have a final question, Mark. I agree physics doesn't disprove strong emergence, but seeing as nothing else in physics works, anything like you suppose consciousness does, doesn't it give inductive weight to the idea that there is no strong emergence? But look, again, just... Thanks, Mark. Just thinking in terms of... Bayesian reasoning, you think, what if this is how you do Bayesian reasoning, right? You think, as I'm sure you know, Mark, assume the hypothesis, what evidence would you expect? Right, so assume there is strong emergence, which is by definition that things run a bit differently in complex biological systems. Would you expect that to show up in experiments with small numbers of particles? Of course you wouldn't. So, you know, the fact that, I mean, and this all seems to come back to locality. So, you know, the fact that locality looks like a good idea works really well when your whole task is explaining experiments with small numbers of particles, which is Sean's task essentially. Well, does that show? I mean, I don't think that shows much. I mean, look, very weakly. As I've always said, maybe there's a very weak simplicity constraint here. If I didn't think there were these philosophical arguments of strong emergence, yeah, I'd just go for simplicity with the core theory. But at best, a very weak consideration, I think. All right. Lots more questions. But Joachim saying, what would the data of phenomenal consciousness look like? You're looking at it. Yeah, okay. Okay, well, I think I better leave it there. I was only going to go for half an hour and I've got to feed some children. Thanks. Always welcome to hear more comments. I'm sure we can continue arguing on Twitter. But if Barry and and or Sean would like to come on to give their responses, they're very welcome. But I appreciate also these debates can't go on forever. Please do subscribe, like the video, send it to your grandmother, and next Mind Chat, Smellosopher, and Sophie Barrich, and then Angela Mendelovici on how consciousness connects us to reality. I might start a solo podcast as well. I'm a bit jealous of Keith's got a solo podcast, and I might start a solo podcast and talk about wacky things we're not allowed to talk about on Mind Chat. I'm only joking. There aren't things we're not allowed to. Well, it's more consciousness-based, I guess. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. It's very kind. It's wonderful that I can share these ideas and get some interesting feedback. I'm sure the conversation will continue. And, oh no, how do I end without Keith? I didn't think ahead. I just thought about what I'm going to say. Well, I certainly agree with myself that, you know, consciousness is wherever it is and nowhere else.